Welcome to this new detailed edition of the BayPay Forum Blockchain News. My name is Cindy and today is February 24, 2020. This edition is brought to you by PayCademy, the first business academy to learn payments and fintech. If you have some news in payments and fintech, send it to us at press@baypayforum.com and we will do our best to include your news. In this edition, we will talk about New Simpsons episode features Jim Parsons giving a crypto explainer for the masses. Crucial for central banks to consider digital currencies, Bank of England exec. SEC to decide the fate of another Bitcoin ETF proposal this week. Blockchain pioneer Caitlin Long to build crypto bank in Wyoming. China has many strategic reasons to invest in blockchain. How to protect Bitcoin for your heirs with the push of a dead mouse button. How the Ethereum Foundation got UNICEF to embrace blockchain. Central bankers from Canada, Netherlands, Ukraine call blockchain unnecessary for digital fiat. On EOS blockchain, vote buying is business as usual. Now let's get started. New Simpsons episode features Jim Parsons giving a crypto explainer for the masses. The latest episode of The Simpsons delved into the complex world of cryptocurrencies, managing to break the subject down so just about anyone can understand it. Titled Frinkcoin, the show listed on Fox on February 24 features TV's most beloved scientist and the Big Bang Theory star Jim Parsons as he appears on screen to talk about the really cool subject of distributed consensus-based cryptocurrency. For cryptocurrencies to work, we need a record of every transaction that occurs. These are recorded in what's called a distributed ledger, Parsons, who's definitely not a nerd, says. Enter an animated ledger book that sings, in a slow blues style, a good portion of the tutorial. I'm a consensus of shared and synchronized digital data. Spread across multiple platforms from Shanghai to Granada. Each day I'm closer to being cash of the future. Not in your wallet, I'm in your computer. When you use the currency, the transaction is recorded in the ledger, Parsons continues, and when one ledger book gets filled up, we add to a chain of previous books, that's the blockchain. According to a press release, Parsons voiced himself for the episode, which features Professor Frink as the subject of a Lisa Simpson school essay, creating his own Frinkcoin cryptocurrency. Ultimately, he surpasses Mr. Burns as richest man in Springfield. The snippet also takes a dig at the crypto space with a concluding text that raises the environmental cost of cryptocurrency production and ends with a statement referring to the mysterious inventor of Bitcoin. Also, we know who Satoshi is, but we're not telling. Crucial for central banks to consider digital currencies, Bank of England exec. The Bank of England's, BO, chief cashier, Sarah John, said it is crucial central banks research digital currencies so they can strike a balance with private issuers. John said it was really important BO and other central banks considered whether digital currencies could form the basis of a new payment system and, if so, quicken the pace on determining how to regulate the new asset class. The BO needs to consider its position on the technology to ensure the UK has a broad range of payments that it can use with confidence, John said, as reported by the Daily Telegraph on Saturday. It is absolutely right that central banks think about whether a public sector or private sector would be best to provide a digital currency going forward. John, who is the BO's chief cashier is responsible for issuing banknotes in the UK, said it was so crucial that central banks also determine how to define the role of private companies issuing their own cryptocurrencies in future, such as Facebook's involvement with the Libra project. The BO was one of seven financial institutions that co-founded a new working group in January with the aim of sharing research and findings into central bank digital currencies, CBDCs. Other working group members include Sweden's Riksbank, which announced Friday it would soon pilot a new e-krona initiative, expected to run until 2021, that would increase the bank's knowledge of CBDCs by testing the digital currency in a series of scenarios and stress tests. Sources have also told the Japan Times that the Bank of Japan, BOJ, another member of the working group, has had several meetings with the Finance Ministry and Financial Services Agency, FSA, to discuss potential economic effects of digital currencies as well as move forward on collaborative research. BOJ Governor Haruhiko Kuroda said, "We are advancing research and study from the technical and legal perspectives so that we will be able to move in an appropriate way when there is a growing need." Japanese politicians had expressed concern digital currencies, such as the one being developed by China, could seriously challenge the existing dollar-based economic order. Although there were no plans to launch a digital currency, the BOJ deputy governor said in January the bank was laying the groundwork by researching the technology. SEC to decide the fate of another Bitcoin ETF proposal this week. The U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, is once again poised to approve or reject a Bitcoin exchange-traded fund ETF, when Wilshire Phoenix United States Bitcoin and Treasury Investment Trust meets a filing deadline Wednesday. Wilshire Phoenix is the latest in a long line of companies hoping to secure SEC approval to list shares of a Bitcoin-related ETF, and the only one that has an active application before the securities regulator. Such an instrument would allow retail investors to get exposure to the Bitcoin market without what some see as the added difficulty of owning Bitcoin itself, potentially boosting market participation by individuals wary of Bitcoin's stance as an unregulated investment. While its chances are slim, the SEC has yet to approve any Bitcoin ETF applications for a multitude of stated reasons. The company was filing updates to its proposal as recently as last week in efforts to bolster its application. Wilshire managing partner William Herman told CoinDesk that he was optimistic about the filing, saying in a phone call last week that we wouldn't have filed it if we didn't think that it would be approved. To boost its chances, the amended S-1 filed on February 14 now includes an entire additional section on underwriters, though no specific entities are named. The filing also now includes Wilshire Phoenix fees, $2,437, its maximum share price, $2,500, and a number of shares it intends to register initially, 8,040. The firm filed the ETF application in mid-2019, with the regulator repeatedly postponing any decision, leading to the final February 26 deadline. In rejecting ETFs previously, the SEC has pointed to concerns about market manipulation, the Bitcoin market's overall size, and a need for surveillance sharing agreements as some factors it considers. Wilshire is attempting to address these concerns by composing its ETF with a basket that automatically rebalances itself between U.S. Treasury bonds and Bitcoin in response to the cryptocurrency's volatility. As volatility goes up, the basket favors bonds, and vice versa. Herman previously told CoinDesk that in his view, this automatic rebalancing reduces the risk to investors. What are the odds? The SEC certainly appears to be paying attention to the filing. According to public documents, Commissioners Hester Pierce and Allison Herron-Lee both met with representatives from Wilshire Phoenix, NYSE Aka, and their law firms. The Division of Trading and Markets met with representatives from the companies in January, as well as twice last year, to discuss the proposal. Still, the SEC's thinking on the proposal remains opaque. Wilshire's Herman, reiterating a point often brought up in favor of Bitcoin ETFs, told CoinDesk the product would allow a wider group of investors to safely access what is essentially a new asset class. "We want to provide easy access to strategies that are often only limited to institutions or accredited investors," Herman said. "Restraining who is able to invest in any product or strategy on the basis of socioeconomic status or for any reason is simply wrong. This leaves many exposed to sudden market volatility followed by likely losses due to lack of diversification." The Bitcoin ETF Wilshire has proposed is actually one in a larger family of such products. The company has also filed to issue a gold and treasury-backed ETF. Herman said he believes creating multiple investment strategies for consumers is a part of its overall strategy. We're confident we will have the Bitcoin ETF soon, and the gold ETF won't be far behind. We are aiming to launch a lot more products as well, Herman said. Blockchain pioneer Caitlin Long to build crypto bank in Wyoming. The U.S. may soon get its first dedicated bank for digital assets. A Wyoming corporation founded by blockchain legislative champion and Wall Street veteran Caitlin Long is preparing to apply for a Special Purpose Depository Institution (SPDI) charter with the state's Division of Banking. The future bank is called Avanti, which means forward in Italian, and will be focused solely on providing regulated services for digital assets, Long announced Monday. The company, formed on January 6, has already raised $1 million in seed funding. Avanti will provide payment, custody, securities and commodities activities for institutional customers using digital assets. While the company has yet to submit its application, it already has 8 products in its pipeline that are not currently available in the U.S. market, the only named one being custody for security tokens. Because trust companies cannot custody securities under U.S. law, SPDIs are uniquely positioned to fill the gap. Avanti's balance sheet is planned to hold more assets under administration than deposits, and profits will be generated by providing services to institutional clients, similar to large traditional custody banks such as State Street, Bank of New York Mellon and Northern Trust. Long described the business as a money warehouse. The firm will custody digital assets without any change in the ownership of those assets, like a valet takes care of your car without being given its legal title, Long said. Blockstream partnership. Under Wyoming state law, SPDI banks must keep all of customers' fiat demand deposits as liquid assets and cannot lend. However, these entities get to operate under the regulatory oversight of the crypto-friendly Wyoming Division of Banking instead of the U.S. Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC. Avanti is partnering with Bitcoin and blockchain technology startup Blockstream, which will provide Bitcoin applications, as well as the software and hardware needed to custody digital assets. Blockstream brings software for the Bitcoin protocol. Avanti brings a regulated delivery vehicle to deliver it into the USD markets, Long said in an email. With Blockstream's Liquid, a sidechain or parallel network sometimes used to move money between exchanges, the company will able to develop a one-stop shop for digital asset custody, said Blockstream CEO and co-founder Adam Back. With Blockstream, Avanti can build adjacent blockchain application programming interfaces, APIs, and conventional banking APIs, Back said. The first might look like an API that initiates multi-signature transactions, the second is usually an API that transfers money between traditional banking ledgers. Long, who pushed for the creation of the SPDI charter, said she didn't plan on forming an SPDI bank until last Christmas when she was visiting Rome. Prior to her trip, a group which Long would not name approached her about creating such an entity. Because of the high capital level required to start an SPDI around $25 million, many potential applicants have been slow to seek approval, even though the regulatory door been open since last October. Currently, the Wyoming Division of Banking has only received 2 applications, which the regulator is working with applicants to refine. In Rome, Long had been talking to Back on the phone when she became convinced to start Avanti. Back is a well-known cryptographer who regularly talked with Satoshi Nakamoto during Bitcoin's BTC early days and was cited in Nakamoto's Bitcoin white paper for having created Hashcash, a predecessor technology that inspired the first cryptocurrency. When in Rome, the setting was appropriate. While they spoke, Long walked between the Imperial Forums and the Roman Forums. There she saw for the first time a rostra, a large platform for delivering speeches. A symbol of decentralized power where citizens gathered to debate and engage in commerce voluntarily during the Republic, she said. With Back, she talked about the need for big money pension funds, endowments, foundations, corporations and sovereign wealth funds to have a regulated partner to deliver services around Bitcoin. It's a $300 billion asset class and they can't ignore it anymore, Long said. Their existing service providers aren't able to help them. That night she landed on the name Avanti. It's a fitting name for a bank that's moving ahead, while also anchored in the history of sound money and clear property rights, she said. Seeking perfection. Having finalized the requirements for applications, the Wyoming Division of Banking is now developing the policies and procedures for SPDI banks and defining how the regulator will perform its yearly examination and supervision processes. To do this, the regulator is speaking to other state banking regulators to ensure the charter can transport to other states. Wyoming is integrating digital assets into the U.S. banking system for the first time, said Chris Land, general counsel at the state's banking division. The first applications that go through the process literally have to be perfect because many of the top financial industry officials in the country will be following the process. Perfection, like art, takes time. With a lot of trust placed in us by very important people, Land said that the process will not be rushed. Wyoming is a leader in responsible financial innovation, so we have to get this right, he added. The Wyoming legislature has several blockchain initiatives coming up later this year, including bills that would expand the blockchain task force into a select committee, provide First Amendment protections to code as long as it isn't written in a malicious way, and extend the SPDI charter's field of service to include retail customers. It's going to take a little while for folks to get their arms around all that we've done, said Tyler Lindholm, a Wyoming state representative and chairman of the Wyoming Blockchain Task Force. Blockstream being able to partner with Caitlin Long is a big win for them. Ms. Long knows the charting process. She knows financial regulation inside and out. China has many strategic reasons to invest in blockchain. Bern Hobart, a CoinDesk columnist, is an investor, consultant and writer in New York. His newsletter, The Diff, diff.substack.com, covers inflection points in finance and technology. In October, China's President Xi Jinping said China should seize the opportunity to use the blockchain. To cryptocurrency advocates, this is exciting and confusing. Why would a deeply centralized country want to use an intrinsically decentralized technology? Why would a country that exercises tight control over its currency want to try a new, untested currency system? The paradoxical answer is Xi Jinping isn't thinking like an engineer, although Xi himself has a BS in chemical engineering from Tsinghua. He's actually in a different mindset entirely, somewhere between corporate blockchain consultant and ICO scammer. Like many technological abstractions, blockchains are useful in certain domains where their trade-offs make sense. If you need a system with no trusted third party at the cost of lower throughput, it's great. If you're fine with trusted third parties, as most consumers of financial services are, and need to handle lots of concurrent transactions, as existing payment platforms do, it's not so great. But blockchain is also a social technology, a way to make otherwise boring issues exciting. The biggest impact blockchain has had on traditional banks is it briefly convinced them back-office functions like clearing were trendy and worth investing in. Since back-office functions were the first to be automated, they run on fairly creaky technology, generally designed by people who are now retired or dead. The remaining COBOL cowboys do very well under this arrangement. They can redirect that hype towards other goals. Officials at the Chinese Communist Party know that blockchain is a popular technology, and they probably know the applications are presently limited. But they can redirect that hype towards other goals. It's atypical for a head of state to get really excited about ways to slightly optimize a country's back-office IT systems. But there are two reasons for him to care about using blockchain. Optimistically, a blockchain-based title system could solve a major problem in Chinese lending. It's relatively easy for borrowers to reuse the same collateral. This is hard to measure. If you could measure it, you could fix it, and it won't be visible until borrowers start to default and more than one lender attempts to seize the same collateral. Pessimistically, a new digital currency would give China a head start in escaping dollar hegemony, tying China's economy more closely with Belt and Road Initiative investment recipients and Russia. It's the latter scenario that represents the most interesting and important blockchain application. Right now, global trade is dominated by the dollar. Intra-European trade happens in euros, and Japan settles transactions in yen. But most trade between countries not part of the eurozone is still settled in dollars. This gives the U.S. a powerful foreign policy tool. America uses sanctions, against individuals and companies, to enforce policy goals. Since almost every global financial institution needs to use dollars, they all end up complying. This doesn't just involve U.S. regulators punishing U.S. companies for violations. America has also gone after French banks for violating U.S. sanctions, even though their transactions were legal in France. It's somewhat analogous to China's habit of penalizing American companies for treating Taiwan as a country. In the China-Taiwan case, China can threaten to interfere with companies' business in China. In the U.S. sanctions case, the U.S. can unilaterally cripple any major global financial institution, since so many of them do business in dollars and crucially have dollar-denominated liabilities they need to roll over. If China announced, as a policy matter, that it was trying to de-dollarize their economy, it would spark panic. Getting off the dollar is enormously expensive and inconvenient, and if they urgently want to do so, it implies they're panicking because staying on a dollar-based system is scarier than risking a crisis. But if China is exploring a cool new technology, a modern and decentralized system, it doesn't sound like panic at all. It sounds like openness and progress. It sounds like China relaxing its grip on citizens' financial transactions, rather than increasing its control over trading partners. Of course, we don't know what the implementation of a Chinese digital-first currency would look like. We don't know how much anonymity will be built in. But here's something we do know: pseudonymous currency systems like Bitcoin, BTC, get de-anonymized when people change money to and from fiat. When the feds catch one crypto money launderer, they'll end up catching all of that person's clients. The CCP is the single organization best positioned to de-anonymize any given Chinese cryptocurrency user, given its in-depth tracking of all online behavior and its mandatory facial recognition for smartphones. Anyone who has spent time in the blockchain space develops a certain skepticism and a nose for hype. When someone says blockchain, your first question should be, what do they really want? In Xi Jinping's case, the answer is more interesting than average. But if you worry about privacy rights in China or political stability worldwide, it's a lot more worrisome, too. How to protect Bitcoin for your heirs with the push of a dead mon's button? What happens to your Bitcoin after you die? This is more than just a philosophical question. It could involve a substantial amount of currency. The question of crypto and the great beyond is what prompted about 20 or so developers to get together in London recently to experiment with repurposing the current Lightning protocol to send private messages as a dead man's button, a system that can't be censored and would keep your crypto safe for your heirs. Lightning Labs infrastructure engineer Joost Jaeger has been exploring using Lightning for messaging over the past year. At the Advancing Bitcoin conference in London, Jaeger hosted a workshop to figure out how to build a dead man's button with Lightning. Should he succeed, he said, it would show the world Lightning can be used as messaging system as well as a payment network. These buttons are not new. At the workshop, Jaeger noted Edward Snowden, the National Security Agency whistleblower, used one in case he died before journalists could reveal the contents of the documents he wanted to make public. The goal of the workshop was to explore one of Lightning's relatively new features, keysend, formerly known as spontaneous payments. It's so experimental it isn't even described in the Lightning specifications yet. But it does offer a way to send data, called custom records in LND, the Lightning implementation Jaeger works on, along with a transaction. Here's how it might work. Imagine a user who wants to pass on a Bitcoin, BTC, inheritance. That user would communicate with a service, pushing a button that would send a message every week or so to signify that the user is still alive. If the button isn't pressed 1 week, it is assumed the Bitcoin user is dead or incapacitated and it's time for the Bitcoin to be passed on, at which point the service automatically dispenses a secret, which can be used to retrieve the crypto. Beyond that, Jaeger thought some additional features should be added, even if they could make the program trickier to implement. The program should maintain the privacy of the sender and the receiver, he said, and should allow the sender to get proof the service still has the secret. Developers split into small groups to think about how to build a service that would meet all of these and other goals. The workshop developers came up with some ideas, which Jaeger published to GitHub. He included a rough implementation, which puts several of the ideas into practice, though he said the code is extremely limited and does not implement everything described. This design isn't necessarily the best way forward, Jaeger said, but it's a proof of concept he hopes can inspire other implementations. Imagination versus loss. Jaeger told CoinDesk the primary reason he chose the dead man's button for the workshop was it is complex enough of a use case that it can show off what Lightning can do as a messaging system. But he also thinks a dead man's button could be a real use case for Lightning down the road. Many people try to arrange their crypto inheritance and need to make up their minds about who they trust. This could be an alternative, assuming that wrinkles are ironed out and the whole process is hidden underneath a user-friendly shell, he said. This is unlikely to happen short-term, but I hope people see the possibilities. Lawyer Pamela Morgan, an expert on crypto inheritance and author of a book dedicated to helping people develop a plan to pass on their crypto, agrees with Jaeger the technology is far from ready. But she said she would not encourage users to put any money into any experimental dead man's button systems just yet. Dead man switches are fun projects that excite our imaginations but fail to solve the complex and multidisciplinary challenges of crypto asset inheritance distribution. Relying on such solutions for something as important as inheritance is likely to cause catastrophic loss, she told CoinDesk. However, she said the technology has promise. Since few crypto enthusiasts have any sort of a plan for what to do with their currencies after they are gone, she's happy to see people exploring ways to make crypto inheritance a more common practice. If adding a dead man switch makes more people actually do inheritance planning for their Bitcoin, then I'm all for it because so few people actually do anything, she told CoinDesk. In the meantime, Jaeger is pressing on with beefing up Lightning's messaging system so it can be used to make a dead man's button a living reality. How the Ethereum Foundation got UNICEF to embrace blockchain? Donating to the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, may turn out to be the Ethereum Foundation's shrewdest move yet. We are still discussing the details on what we can do together, but we have decided to continue support for the next couple of years, said Ethereum Foundation Director Aya Miyaguchi. I believe a partnership with a group like UNICEF can maximize our impact without shifting our focus from what we still need to do to improve Ethereum as a technology. The foundation donated roughly $150,000 worth of Bitcoin, BTC, and Ether, ETH, to UNICEF's Experimental Crypto Fund in October 2019. Since then, the UNICEF Kazakhstan office has developed an Ethereum-based system for processing internal payments, such as sending funds from the UNICEF headquarters to people running a local education program. We can see now clearly it's operational and it's great for the organization. So we will continue to work on that, said UNICEF partnership specialist Oleksandra Gaskevich. We only have used Ethereum so far, for smart contracts. We're thinking maybe we could test Bitcoin as well for digital currency transfers, so we'll see. The Kazakhstan-based team is still putting a few finishing touches on the smart contract platform, because UNICEF budgets require multiple signatures from people with varying degrees of clearance. Today, a significant amount of office paperwork still involves people double-checking expenditures by hand. So this new digital process is much more efficient. Gaskevich said the office expects to start transitioning over to the Ethereum-based system in 2021. We can easily adapt it to other Russian-speaking countries in the region, she added. Tunisian pilots. Elsewhere, UNICEF is also partnering with SoftBank Investment Advisors (SBIA) to develop a structure for distributing cryptocurrency. Chris Fabian, co-lead of UNICEF Ventures, said so far the crypto fund is starting slow by funding several startups like Coinsense, a Tunisian token project experimenting with ERC-20 tokens for community currencies. Coinsense founder Kareem Chabrak said more than 200 people in the beach town of Hammamet, with roughly 100,000 residents, participated in a pilot program that is graduating to a fully operational phase this quarter. There are communities that have no money and a lot of unemployed youth, Chabrak said. Communities need to be able to address that without waiting for governments to act. Residents mainly use the token to pay youth for jobs at local restaurants and resorts, then offer them a discount at particular businesses. Chabrak said the goal is to reduce the unemployment rate and encourage productive spending habits. This year, Chabrak said he is establishing a national association with a legal framework to support any other community that wants to issue its own local token. We heard about Bitcoin in 2010, Chabrak said. But we are trying to build currencies that aren't speculative, that are part of the commons. All of these experiments were funded by the Ethereum Foundation, which also acts as a consulting resource but not an official partner like SBIA. For example, Coinsense received 50 Ether, most of which was used for pilots and research in late 2019. Likewise, the Argentinian startup Addix Labs received a Bitcoin from the Ethereum Foundation's donation, and developed software tools that Fabian said may be useful for the program in Kazakhstan. Fabian said last year's donation from the Ethereum Foundation was part of a larger agreement with them, that we had to test some of the piping with them first. Multi-pronged approach. The Ethereum community is investing in global outreach through this agreement with UNICEF, even without directly implementing blockchain solutions. They've made the community available to us for a variety of things, Fabian said. This created a ripple effect beyond the donations themselves. For example, Gaskevich said basic materials related to blockchain technology and smart contracts were incorporated into the Kazakhstan office's digital literacy program for youth, teaching 200 people about Ethereum so far. As UNICEF looks to transition its internal system and find external partners willing to accept Ether, the team is focused on training local talent to develop customized solutions for specific needs. Fabian clarified only a few of UNICEF's external partners in Kazakhstan are willing to accept cryptocurrency for the services they already provide, like an internet service provider or a construction company. That's fine, we're not trying to push it, he said. It's not that we are only paying them in crypto, we're also paying them in fiat, so there's a little bit of hedge. Over the next 2 years, Fabian said UNICEF's goal is to help schools without internet connections get online by supporting local tech ventures, some of which may choose to run their own cryptocurrency nodes and earn revenue from providing connectivity to people and businesses in the surrounding neighborhoods. That's how UNICEF aims to make this project sustainable beyond one-off donations. In addition to the global school initiative, called Giga, Chabrak said he hopes community currencies in Tunisia will be designed to help nonprofits and universities promote the United Nations sustainability goals by incentivizing eco-friendly habits. Why ETH? To be clear, there's one main reason Ethereum became the most widely used blockchain technology across UNICEF's global development strategy, which seeks to deploy nearly $45 billion in diverse programs around the world. The reason is the Ethereum Foundation reached out and ponied up. Even though the donation was a tiny fraction of UNICEF's related budget, the agreement Fabian referenced motivated his fund to set up a compliant system for receiving and distributing cryptocurrency. The fund also accepts Bitcoin, but there have been hardly any Bitcoin donations so far, Fabian said. Based on his research in Tunisia, Chabrak said the most challenging part of getting people to use cryptocurrency was inspiring a sense of personal ownership over an asset that isn't associated with a familiar entity, like the government. That's why foreign startup tokens, and to some extent Bitcoin, have been a harder sell. Communities are not so motivated to build an ecosystem around the currency because they don't identify with the currency and have full control, he said. People accept the coins when they know the people that are issuing the coins and they can implement their own governance. The fact such communities don't see Bitcoin as something they can control and influence the governance of may be, in part, a misunderstanding. With that in mind, the Ethereum Foundation's strategy of finding an indirect way to fund blockchain education and entrepreneurship in emerging markets, where other computer science resources are scarce, may eventually set it apart among blockchain projects competing for both market and mind share. Cryptocurrency is too often seen as a means for investment, but as you know, Ethereum is capable of so much more than that, Miyaguchi said. Whether with UNICEF or other parties, we are always looking for ways to maximize our impact using the technology that we're helping to build. Central bankers from Canada, Netherlands, Ukraine call blockchain unnecessary for digital fiat. Kiev, Ukraine's central bank digital currencies, CBDCs, have been a hot topic in blockchain circles recently, but central banks are lukewarm about blockchains. Representatives of a number of the world's central banks discussed their CBDC projects last week in Kiev, Ukraine. The one-day conference was arranged by the National Bank of Ukraine, or NBU, which itself is a CBDC pioneer, having run its own digital currency pilot in 2018. The central bank wanted to test its ideas and conclusions with the banking community and stimulate the discussion, the head of its innovative development department, Roman Hartinger, told CoinDesk. The speakers included representatives of NBU's peers from Canada, Japan, Lithuania, Finland, Netherlands, Belarus, Uruguay, and South Africa. The discussion comes at a time when the world's two largest economies are each seriously exploring the possibility of issuing a CBDC, although China appears to be much further down the road than the US. According to a report issued in September, NBU started exploring the idea of a digital currency, named e-hryvnia after Ukraine's national currency, as early as 2016. In 2018, the central bank tested a digital token running on a fork, or modified copy, of the Stellar blockchain. The pilot was run with the tech startup Attic Lab, fintech companies UiPay and OMP 2013 and with Big Four professional services firm Deloitte as an auditor, the report says. From September to December 2018, the NBU tested the software with a limited set of participants. The tests showed that there are no fundamental advantages in using specifically the DLT, distributed ledger technology, to build a centralized e-hryvnia issuance system in which NBU is the only issuer, the report says. However, the central bank does not rule out an alternative decentralized model, in which multiple trusted payment processors would issue e-hryvnia. The experiment is on hold, awaiting more input from the banking community and legislation regulating digital assets in Ukraine. While there are some drafts and concepts circulated by the country's authorities, formal laws are yet to be passed. Cool on crypto. The skepticism about distributed ledgers was shared by Hartinger's colleagues from the Netherlands and Canada at the Kiev conference. The essence of the DLT infrastructure is that no single party should be trusted enough, but don't we just trust a central bank to maintain the integrity of the global ledger? Said Harro Buven, policy advisor in the Payments Policy Department of the Dutch Central Bank. Scott Hendry, senior special director of FinTech at Bank of Canada, which piloted its Jasper project, built on R3's Corda DLT platform, last year, agreed that you don't need a DLT to make a central bank digital currency. There doesn't seem to be a lot of benefits if you look at a DLT system and the current efficient centralized system for the sole purpose of interbank payments, Hendry said, adding that in the back office he leads, they wouldn't change anything in the technology stack currently in use. No speaker ruled out using DLT for a CBDC in principle, but none showed much enthusiasm about the tech. A wake-up call. Then why even bother to create central bank digital currencies, the concept that initially was pitched as a trusted, government-blessed kind of cryptocurrency? The reason is Facebook's Libra, says Jamil Sheikh, the CEO of consulting firm Chainhouse. While the project met strong pushback from the governments across the globe, the thought of a big private company issuing its own digital currency sent waves all around financial circles. The era of private money is here, and it's something they have to pay attention to. It's a response to a threat that can stimulate innovation, Sheikh told CoinDesk. Hartinger also pointed at the atypical competitive situation central banks found themselves in. Central banks see big tech issuing stablecoins, like Libra, they see this niche of digital money and now it's the matter of who will have a money issuance prerogative, governments or the private tech companies? Hartinger told CoinDesk. Libra was a wake-up call for us. Central banks have been challenged to innovate, Harrow Bovin said on stage, echoing recent comments by none other than U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell. A representative of one of the central banks present at the conference, who shared his thoughts with CoinDesk offstage and asked not to be identified, said Libra catalyzed a process of exploration that has been long overdue. However, he said he's not worried about the competition from Facebook. People would want to use Libra if our monetary system screwed up. Our best defense is to do our job, he said. Dirtying their hands. Still, not all the central banks have given up on blockchains yet. Sveriges Riksbank, the central bank of Sweden, which recently announced a pilot for a digital krona, or e-krona, together with consulting firm Accenture, is going to use R3's Corda blockchain. The e-krona is a kind of electronic cash for everyday use, a tool for payments between households, denominated in the national currency and accessible 24/7, Riksbank's senior policy advisor to the payments department Bjorn Siegendorf said on stage. Siegendorf told CoinDesk the Riksbank will try out the Corda technology not because the central bank has its mind set on a blockchain-based solution, you just need to try different things to learn. We need to get our hands dirty, he explained. Now it's trying Corda, later, it can try something else. The main point of the exercise is to be ready for the cashless future, Siegendorf said, as young adults rely less and less on cash, to see what such a world looks like and how a central bank can deal with it, so that if we need to issue a CBDC we don't have to start from scratch. On EOS blockchain, vote buying is business as usual. Buying votes is a big no-no in traditional democracies, but on the world's eighth largest blockchain it's become an accepted way of doing business. A new service makes it easier for EOS block producers, the nodes elected by holders of the cryptocurrency to validate transactions on the network, to share their block rewards with those who voted for them. The service, known as Genpool, was introduced this month by Genner EOS, which itself is a block producer candidate. Back when EOS.io, the software powering the $3.7 billion EOS chain, was just an idea, the crypto community debated whether delegated proof of stake, or DPoS, would lead to validation candidates effectively bribing users to support them. DPoS is a consensus mechanism that limits the number of node validators to a fixed set. Early on, the EOS community believed it could prevent such activity. Now the community is all in on what proponents call voter rebates. The Genpool platform is a zero-barrier-to-entry free market ecosystem, connecting proxy owners with voters that are looking to support quality block producers, BPs, while being rewarded with a percentage of the additional BP income, Genner EOS said in a Medium post announcing the service. Genarios's Tim Weston declined an interview with CoinDesk. While similar services have launched in Asia, Genpool appears to be the first in the English-speaking EOS world explicitly designed to help token holders find the best payouts for their votes from block producers. Like Bitcoin, BTC, miners, EOS block producers are rewarded with freshly minted cryptocurrency for recording transactions on the public ledger. In short, Genpool lets EOS holders get paid to participate in governance. To critics, this fulfills long-standing fears that in a system where governance is delegated, the richest will dominate. Permitting payments makes it even easier for the wealthiest to cement their position. There is nothing stopping a validator from acting as if it were more than one entity, allowing whales to hold multiple spots on the governing council of block producers, effectively mounting a Sybil attack, the research team at the Binance Cryptocurrency Exchange wrote in a report released February 18. A single actor may register multiple block producer accounts and multiply their voting weight at a negligible cost, the report said. Simultaneously, having multiple BP entities allows that actor to allocate more block rewards to voters, increasing the competitiveness of the underlying actor. Binance stopped withdrawals of EOS tokens in late January when it saw instability on the network, possibly due to upgrades to the latest version of the EOSIO software released by Block 1. Other exchanges such as Upbit and OKEX paused withdrawals at the time. What are proxies? Genpool will probably sound a little convoluted to those who aren't well-versed in EOS, so hang tight. To recap, every EOS holder has the option to stake their tokens to the vote for block producers, the entities that validate transactions on the network and ultimately hold all power over code changes and even wallet validity. In fact, getting enough votes staked was the big holdup for launching EOS after Block 1 released the EOSIO software. Each holder can vote for up to 30 block producers, but they don't have to. Votes are allocated in proportion to the amount of currency the voter holds. If someone has 5 EOS and stakes it all to vote, each block producer candidate they voted for gets 5 votes, whether the holder picked 3, 7 or 17 of them. These votes run continuously, so a block producer can be in, out again 10 minutes later and in again 10 minutes after that. But deciding on 30 entities to vote for is hard. Hence, voter proxies have arisen on EOS. These services choose a slate of BP candidates to vote for and voters can simply point their EOS at the proxy. Because the proxies get rewards when they vote for BPs who share their inflation rewards, they can in turn share those rewards with voters who back them. Genpool is going one step further, making it easy to find proxies with attractive rewards and other attributes that the voter might be looking for, such as fee, philosophy, stake volume and etc. Against it, then for it. When EOS was first getting off the ground, an arduous process CoinDesk covered closely in 2018, the early participants spent a lot of time coming up with a constitution to govern the ecosystem. That draft constitution banned vote buying and reflected a consensus among the grassroots organizations that launched EOS. But EOS launched without incorporating any governance process into its code beyond picking BPs. When the blockchain went up, the whales rolled in and the constitution was proven to be a dead letter from the jump. In late 2018, vote buying made for a mild scandal on EOS. The following year, EOS dropped the idea of a constitution for an end-user license agreement with no mention of vote buying at all. Today, vote buying is not only tolerated, it's normal. Colin Talks Crypto, a pseudonymous YouTuber and proxy leader who is long EOS but critical of its current governance, created a voting proxy specifically to fight vote buying. But in a video released in September, he acknowledged the realities of vote buying and announced he was creating a second proxy that supported the best block producer that buy votes. Brendan Bloomer, the CEO of Block 1, which created the software that runs the EOS blockchain, has also come out in favor of vote buying. Voter rebates just drive value back to token holders, Bloomer tweeted earlier this month. I am a huge supporter. As CoinDesk has previously reported, Block 1 sits on such a large amount of tokens that it could completely change the makeup of the voting structure, but so far it hasn't voted on governance participants. However, Bloomer tweeted February 19 suggesting the company could start voting its tokens this year. B1 voting is coming, he wrote. We're working towards the establishment of a nonprofit entity that will give token holders another voting option and will work to redefine public blockchain viability and competitiveness. It is what it is. The general consensus of crypto thought leaders polled by CoinDesk seems to be this: vote buying and blockchain governance is likely inevitable. CoinShares Chief Strategy Officer Meltem Demirers called crypto governance itself a hot mess, but said a service to help manage the buying and selling of votes was better than an opaque market. Of the idea of a service that makes bidding out votes easy, she wrote, "Great, let's set a transparent price for governance. Collusion, coercion, manipulation, lobbying, bribing and gerrymandering are part and parcel to the processes of modern democracies. It would be foolish to believe that crypto governance would be absent of these forces," she told CoinDesk, echoing similar comments from a year ago. Spencer Bogart, of Blockchain Capital, sounded similarly resigned to the situation, telling CoinDesk, "I think most, if not all, on-chain governance schemes will eventually amount to implicit or explicit vote-buying schemes, so it may be in EOS's interest to simply embrace this fact rather than resist it." Bogart, it should be noted, has been skeptical of EOS since before its launch. Joshua Gans, an economist who's done work on token economics, sees corrosive second-order effects of vote buying. When it becomes normal, he wrote, there is no incentive to really learn about whether someone is a trustworthy node operator and, moreover, there is no payback to being trustworthy. You earn as much as you pay out just to be a node. But he conceded that it could all still work out. The question is whether all of this is bad. After all, the network is being operated and costs are being covered, he wrote. Vitalik, vindicated. For the record, Vitalik Buterin called all of this. The Ethereum ETH creator weighed in on what he saw as the inevitable vote buying to come on EOS in a March 2018 post titled, Governance, Part 2, Plutocracy is Still Bad. Bribery is, in fact, bad, Buterin wrote. There are actually people who dispute this claim. The usual argument has something to do with market efficiency. He argued that vote buying led to centralization in ways that just imitated the old economy crypto was meant to upend. The average voter has only a very small chance of impacting which delegates get selected. Their incentive is to vote for whoever offers the highest and most reliable bribe, he wrote. Indeed, the only real power EOS holders have on the network is to vote block producers in or out. On the Tezos blockchain, by contrast, regular holders vote on code changes. On EOS, even updates are wholly the purview of block producers. That said, voters can kick out BPs at any time, as described above, but there are a lot of voters and only a few BPs, a real imbalance in ease of coordination. The heart of Buterin's prediction about vote buying comes down to cartels. He described how delegate candidates will inevitably start offering better and better terms to voters to win votes, until at some point a block forms to stabilize the instability. Worse, as Binance's report describes, there can even be single-entity cartels, organizations that take up more than one slot on the list of block producers, by pretending to be multiple entities. Rumors of cartels on EOS abound, but clear evidence hasn't yet come to light. Meanwhile, evidence of vote buying has, so that even its discontents have come to accept it. As long as the code allows it, people will do it. Playing by the rules right now is the best we can do on EOS until we can actually fix governance, Colin Talks Crypto said in his video. This concludes our edition for today. We want to thank again PayCademy, the first business school to learn payments and fintech, for their support. You can find more information on their website at paycademy.com. We hope you enjoyed it and see you tomorrow for our next edition.